I inspected them myself, and Sir Kay is firmly in charge of the defence. But if I might say so, as you are one of our strong points, my lord, should we risk your death? That news would be devastating to your people. Yet I know that you want to see the foe with your own eyes. Therefore, I think it would be best if you were accompanied by a war mage, and there is no one more suited to the task than I. Kusi scowled, but nodded. Have your Ranse brought around, spellmonger? Today you shall see how the knights of Beauval comport themselves in battle. Huin, willing. There was a fire in his eyes that was part pride and part frustration, like a boy being made to wait overlong for his name-day presents. I bowed and went to see about Traveller. Much to my surprise, he was already saddled, and Tyndall was grooming him in the stable when I entered. He grinned when I arrived and told me he had guessed that I would want to accompany the troops. Traveller looked magnificent. The boy had a keen eye for horses, and I could tell that he'd also used a few subtle cantrips to make his coat look even glossier than it would have anyway. For a Rouncy gelding, he was almost as handsome as a Destrier. Tyndall also brought down my war staff and my blue riding mantle, and another one of the war wands I'd purchased in Tudri. I thanked him and gave him a few instructions about the tower before I trotted Traveller out to where the other horsemen were assembling. I was actually looking forward to the expedition as much as Kusi. If nothing else, it would get me away from that smell. The battle plan for the Farisian campaign was simple. Not as simple as the first disastrous marine assault on the sea fortress, but not much more complicated. Another great fleet would head out with troops from the Ramir and Castal, and nearly 1,000 mercenary crossbowmen auxiliaries, Merwin's contribution to the fight, aboard, including an entire elite magical corps assembled specifically to try to combat the storms the Mad Mage wrought with his Witchstone, and eventually storm his palace. Meanwhile, under cover of deceptive spells and departing in darkness, a second force would land 300 miles north of Faris, on the eastern side of the narrow, mountainous isthmus that connected Faris with the rest of the world. Its mission would be to hack its way through the jungle, up the mountains, down the mountains, to eventually come up through the swamps north of the city-state, and attack Faris in its unprotected rear. Brilliant strategy, unless you happened to be in that group. I was. The invasion force set out a full 2 months ahead of the planned naval assault. 5,000 Al-Shari infantrymen, 200 combat engineers, a medical corps, and about 50 of us new war college graduates landed on the western side of the peninsula, at the only possible landing point between the mainland and Faris. 6,000 men set out on the long march. Count Odo, a Castali lord with considerable experience in the arts of war, was given command of the overland expedition that hit the beach in the nameless eastern cove that was our staging ground. Cavalry was all but useless there, where the paths through the jungles were too narrow and soft for real horsemanship, and the vegetation so thick and wild that horses could not properly forage. We did have 20 wagons loaded with supplies, but they were drawn by oxen or mules, not horses. Most of the infantry were horribly overdressed. The Narasi ducal troops were used to the much cooler temperatures in the north, not the subtropical climate of Faris. As a result, they left much of their heavy armor and woolen gear behind them on the trail south. Within days, the entire column was dehydrated and ill. Disease was rampant, as were injuries due to heat exhaustion. Desertion would have been common had there been any convenient place to desert to. It took more than 60 days to negotiate our way through the passes and woodlands of the Farisian mountains. Wild human tribes and Govani clans held much of the territory, and to make matters worse, we heard the tantalizing sounds of the tree folk reveling through the jungle on our tortuous trip. We even met with their representatives a few times to try to gain their support. They were polite and steered us clear of dangers they knew of, but they would not aid us directly. Faris had done better than we at gaining friends in the mountains, but then they had more practice. 7 times, human tribes friendly to the Doge ambushed us. Only 2 times were we able to camp peacefully, in the territories of Gavani, who hated the Farisi and their human tribal allies. As helpful as they were, they could not stop the bodies piling up from skirmishes and disease, nor could they feed our large army successfully. We ran short of food, water, medicine, bandages, and other amenities before our march was half over. That endless march through the jungle remains one of my most intense recurring nightmares. The days were a long, hot, and humid exercise in endurance. As a war mage, it was my duty to protect my company from magical attack, but even magic has its limits. It is difficult to concentrate on something as complex as a warding spell when you are dehydrated, physically exhausted, and sleepless. The nights were just as hot, perhaps, but filled with the noise of thousands of creatures our tired minds could only imagine. Snake bite, and bites by other things that weren't snakes, took their toll. If it weren't for the anti-insect cantrips we had to renew thrice daily, we would have been eaten alive by bugs. Nor were we unopposed as we marched. Despite our attempt at surprise, you just can't disguise the movements of an army that large, no matter what spells you cast. The Farisi had centuries of history defending those passes, and while they never brought a real army against us, they sent plenty of warriors to slow us down. There were periodic raids and ambushes, snipers and kidnappings by the Farisi, bad guys. I killed my first man on one of those, almost accidentally, and I lost several good friends to the brutal raids. The dusky Farisi warriors were good soldiers fighting for their homeland, and many of the human tribes in the area were allies of Faris. I'd like to say we gave as good as we got, but that wouldn't be true. Most of the time, the feather-clad warriors faded into the jungle before we could get our defenses ready. We didn't feel like an army expedition. We felt like a bunch of scared and tired little boys lost in the woods after dark. And that was just the jungles. Once we were in the mountains, it got worse. The heat let up because of the altitude, but the cold became worse with every step we took. Massive thunderstorms swept in from the sea almost every night. 4 times we got lost as we tried to navigate the maze of ridges and passes of that wild place. The Farisi resistance was even more pronounced. Every morning, it seemed, we would lose another man or two to something nasty in the night. If it weren't for the timely assistance of the Alka Alon steering us away from a hidden Farisi fortress ready to slaughter us, we wouldn't have made it at all. We were 3 weeks late when we finally spotted the towers of Faris in the distance from the mountain passes. When we drew up to our planned camp, only 3,300 men remained in fighting shape. Only our sheer numbers and a few good commanders got an army to Faris proper at all. It was on the long march that I met Sire Kusi and his men. A Wilderlands mountain lord from the farthest west of the duchies, he had volunteered to serve with 100 of his folk. He had a quaint accent and an engaging smile, and led his troops well. I was assigned to support his unit a few times, and I found him a pleasant companion and a doughty warrior, one of the few knights who kept his armor despite the heat and rarely complained about the lack of horses. Sire Kusi was always encouraging his men to do their best and do their duty with honor under the most trying of circumstances. When Count Odo died of a fever, he was part of the noble council that met to elect his successor. Even at the end of the march, with a third of his men dead or lost to the jungle, he persevered in his duty and kept up the morale of his troops as we prepared to attack Faris from the rear. I respected that, as well as the way he could drink. He was a leader worth following. The damage to Himmer's town wasn't as bad as what we anticipated, though I knew the townsfolk would be devastated by the sight. The Gavani had torn through the town, throwing torches at anything that would burn. They had written what I assumed were obscenities in ash and blood on every conceivable surface, and the blood of whatever farm animals were unfortunate enough to be caught by the goblins was splattered all over the place. Only about a dozen homes had actually burned completely, thanks to the rainy weather and damp thatch, but there was plenty of damage to the others for the sheer hell of it. Doors were bashed in, furniture was hacked with axes, feces were used to pollute household shrines. The streets were strewn with all sorts of cast-off goods rejected as loot, then destroyed for the pleasure of its destruction. A few Gavani lingered there, likely as rear guards or picket troops. I scryed to scout the town as best I could, and discovered a dozen or so camped out in one of the shops. When I told Kusi about it, the old knight angrily dispatched a dozen troopers to torch the place and kill any who tried to escape. While they sought retribution, I rode Traveler to a quiet spot and tried a more potent location spell. I wished that I had time to construct a proper mage map, like I had for Minden's Hall, but Himmus was not my town, so I had to make do with ordinary battlefield scrying. I knew that the Gavanni were still around. The fires and the mess in Himmus were too widespread and thorough to be the work of only a few. The Irionite sphere made it easier to find them by far. I wished I had it in Faerys. As I took a mental walk through Himmus, I did indeed discover a few more outposts and scouts, but the troops I figured had to be massed someplace were not within the town limits. Then I found an area just outside of town that seemed to belie magical scrutiny. Obviously, someone was trying to mask their location, which ironically revealed it to me. While I am not terribly familiar with the town, I did remember a copse of trees to the south of town, known as Reza's How, where some of the local devotees of Yinka, a minor fertility and nature goddess, originally from one of the wild human tribes that the Narasi settlers had adopted, performed their rites. It took a little arcane pressure, but I was able to warp the defending wards and discover the approximate size and nature of the foe. There were a few hundred goblins encamped in a hollow near the center of the grove. That made sense. The Gavanni are not an urban folk. Most of their settlements are small, and a town like Himmus would seem a strange and foreign place to them. They would not try to occupy it as a human army would. The grove gave them a better defensive posture, and one they were more familiar with. The trees would protect the goblins' sensitive eyes from the daytime sun, keep them in comfortably familiar surroundings as they rested, as well as make a cavalry charge dangerous for the cavalry. Once I told Sir Kusi about it, I knew he'd try anyway, and count on the armor of his men and their ferocity to carry the day. That wasn't a particularly bad plan. I didn't relish the thought of fighting tree to tree, but I had a better one. Of all the elemental magics there are, fire is the easiest to summon and the hardest to control. The candle-lighting cantrip is usually among the first spells a student ever learns. It's quite easy. Focus a stream of magical power on one spot, convert magical energy into a directed burst, exciting the atoms of the tinder to incandescence, feed it oxygen, and then heating it up to the point where it bursts into flame. I've seen some magi who were so good at this that they could cause a block of granite to burn like coal. What I had in mind was, by comparison, much easier. While the magical wardings protected the Gavanni from any direct arcane attack, you can't really hit what you can't see. We human war magi are subtle. In this case, I wanted to smoke them out. In 10 minutes, I started a dozen tiny fires at different points in Reza's How by employing the substantial resources of the Witchstone. While it had been almost a week since the last strong rain here, the topmost leaves in the How were dry enough to burn better than the thatched roofs of the town. The cloud cover that the Gavanni shaman had summoned was dark, but not rainy. Most of the woodlands around here could be counted upon to hold a fair amount of underbrush, and the How was no exception. With a little magical encouragement, I found some dry spots that could be ignited at a distance, and once a fire like that is started, it quickly dries the water out of the surrounding vegetation enough to burn it. I placed my tiny blazes well enough to know that their smoke, if not their flames, would become a problem for our Gavanni visitors before long. Then I set my own wards to keep us from being as easily detected as they were. It's not that their wards were poorly cast, it's that they were unsophisticated. Experience had taught me how to go about it properly for situations such as this. I trotted back to where Sir Kusi and Captain Ferrando were milling around on their horses, overseeing patrols and the like. Ferrando was smoking a longish pipe of pungent Sokal root shavings, a nasty Ramiran habit left over from imperial times. My people smoke Vobiril, a pleasant and sweet-smelling herb. Sokal root smells like a used pair of infantry boots when it burns, but the Romerans love the stuff, and Sir Kusi was consulting a small parchment map of the area he brought from the castle. The Lord of Beauval Vale looked stricken upon seeing his lovely town and revenue centre damaged so callously, but his chin was set with determination to take the distraction to his enemy. "My lords, I've scried the area," I began, not bothering to bow, which is hard to do from a horse anyway, "and while I still have a sensible commoner's respect for nobility, I learned in Faris that a count and a peasant are virtually indistinguishable when they've been disemboweled. Your report, spellmonger, have you found them?" Sire Kusi asked, worriedly. "The devastation they have wrought. I have detected a large troop of goblins in the little wood known as Reza's How, just to the south. I used my regular wand to point out the spot on Kusi's map. Their numbers were hidden from me by magic, which means that they have at least one shaman with them, probably using a witchstone. From the size of the shield and the other signs, I would say that there are at least 500 goblins in those woods." Kusi paled a bit, but nodded. Ferrando looked grim and even more depressed. We had less than 20 men with us. "Our horses would be cut to pieces if we got among those trees," the Lord of Beauval Vale said, shaking his head discouragingly. "While I know goblins prefer holes and caves, I can quite imagine that they would take advantage of the trees and drop on our cavalry should we try to drive them from the wood. It's what I would do in their place." Captain Ferrando nodded in agreement. "I concur, Lord, which is why I took the liberty of igniting a number of small fires in the wood by my art. In a quarter candle's time, there should be enough smoke and even some fire to drive them into a clearer space nearby, where we can attack them while they are in disarray."
"Where is this place?"
Ferrando asked curiously. "Will we have room for a proper charge, or must we send for archers from the castle?" I tapped on the map at a spot, just to the west of the How. "If memory serves, this adjacent pasture here, Goodman Ishaf's, will be a natural place for them to regroup from the How, and a suitable battlefield for us. It is low, at the base of the rise that presages the town, and clear of stumps, if memory and magic serve. We can hide our advance from their scouts behind the dome of this hill to the north, and still manage enough room for a cavalry charge, Huon willing. And they aren't expecting us," I reminded them. "They think we're all still holed up in the castle. I doubt their scouts have reported back, if your men were thorough in their attack."
"What of magical intelligence?"
Ferrando asked thoughtfully. "Will their shamans not see us coming? I have placed a shield over the entire town to protect against that, and it is more cleverly designed than their wards. While the goblin witch doctors are canny enough to cover their troops, they did so very selectively. Selectively enough that the very absence of return on that one particular spot in essence revealed their position. That is a mistake I will not repeat. Everything from the lakeshore to the southern road is blanketed by my cloak now." I had done that almost as an afterthought. Easy to do with Irionite. While my wards might reveal the presence of Magi to our foe, it would also hide our movements enough to attack. The Witchstone made them stronger than I could manage on my own, too. It wouldn't hold up to concentrated scrying, but it would make a casual glance at our troop formations difficult, and screen us from a direct arcane attack.
"Well done, Master Spellmonger," Sire Kusi said, a gleam returning to his eye. "Captain, if you will tell off a score of your more lightly armored riders, we can send them around the backside of the How through this field here, and hit them in their flank just before our knight's charge."
"Let's make it 20, the Remiran said. "My light troopers are not as well equipped to make a direct charge, unlike your knights, my lord." That was true enough. More than half of the mercenaries used javelins and bows, not the heavy lances favored by the Wilderlords. By doubling their number thus, we present a more credible distraction. I'll put them under Ancient Irik. He is the most experienced skirmisher in the Black Flag, and has the wisdom to know when to break off.
"Quite right, Captain. Herald!"
Sire Kusi called out for his messenger to relay the orders.
"That's a good plan," I agreed, rubbing the growing hint of beard on my chin. "I think I shall accompany the skirmishers, if you have no objections, Captain. I've no lance, and Traveller is a rouncy, not a charger, and I'd be almost useless in the full assault. But a spell or two might just convince the goblins that the force they face is the real threat, or at least confuse them, which will give the knights ample time to build up speed for a charge. The orders were dispatched quickly, and before too long I was riding with ancient Eric and around 40 other horsemen, south and west, around the back of Reza's howl. Eric was typical of the mercenary soldier I'd seen, deadly serious about his craft and full of black humor. He was perhaps the shortest cavalry trooper I'd ever seen, just a hair over 5 feet, but he rode like he was a growth on his horse's back. We chatted while we rode, but I kept a constant eye on the growing trails of smoke that were coming from the grove. A little more power from the witch stone to feed the flames oxygen kept the smoldering fires lively, and the damp leaves only added to the smoke. I could hear the alarm calls and harsh coughs of the Gavani even without a spell. By the time we had made it to the southern end of the howe and crossed the streamlet, more like a ditch, actually, that bordered it to the west, the woods were actually ablaze enough to see flame, not just smoke. Twice we came across individual Gavani who had escaped from the smoke by fording the stream, only to be cut down by our arrows with the sun in their eyes. It almost didn't seem fair, and for the briefest moment I regretted the odds. But then I remembered the bodies of my helpless neighbors in Minden's hall, hacked apart by night, and that steeled my heart for the slaughter to come. I felt a wave of magical energy pass just as we crossed the stream, and I readied a defense. But it was not directed at us, I thought. It took me a while to puzzle out the radically different style of magic used by my Gavani colleagues, but I sensed that the spell was more a hastily built fire-dampening casting than combat magic. No doubt the shamans concluded that some idiot on watch had let the cook fires get out of control, or something similar. That happened often enough when I was in the army. There are such idiots in every unit, I think. I was tempted to throw something nasty at them, but knew that might spoil the surprise of our attack when we were counting on it. Instead, I chuckled and countered with a slow, steady breeze from the west, which fanned the flames even higher, and covered the pasture to the east with a thick blanket of smoke. That would make a dampening spell more difficult. Gavani were already pouring out of the wood as it began to burn in earnest, as the pine trees, thick with sap, started to catch fire. Reza's howe would be no more than a well-fertilized field when we were done. I hoped the goddess would understand. A quick check by scrying also told me that whomever had been holding that warding spell was distracted enough by the unexpected fire to let it slip away. My spell showed a large knot of little black figures spilling out into the eastern pasture, in no particular order. I waited until at least 3/4 of them were safely out before I began to hang a few more useful combat spells. When I was done, I signaled to Eric, and he quickly formed up his men for the charge. Being part of a cavalry charge is one of the most exhilarating and terrifying experiences you can have. On the one hand, your heart races as the artificial thunder of horses' hooves overwhelms every other sound, and the sensation of pure speed overtakes you. On the other hand, there is the very realistic possibility that your horse will mistakenly run into the point of a spear or a pike, or that he will simply step into a hole and send you flying. Traveller was a pretty smart beast compared to most horses, but even he got carried away in the charge. Horses love to run fast in a herd, and even a Rouncey like Traveller must have fantasies of being a destrier or charger. As we approached the thick cloud of smoke and the thicker crowd of unorganized, choking and coughing Gavani, he did not slow or break stride. The foe ahead, a group of more than 100, finally realized they were actually under attack, and not just the subject of misfortune. They were clearly dismayed at our approach, an emotion enhanced by the 3 useful war spells I cast to aid us. One, an illusion to make our number seem twice as large as they were, one to amplify the noise we made, and one targeted directly at their fear. With the Witchstone, I was spending energy like a soldier on leave spends his pay. We closed in fast. Arrows twanged from bows, and javelins were hurled at the black mass of goblins before our men shifted to weapons suited to hand-to-hand fighting. They might not have carried lances, but their swords, maces, axes, and hammers were more than a match for the goblins' comparatively puny weapons. As Eric's men ploughed into the mass of shrieking goblins, swords waving and spears thrusting, the confusion of the collision was sufficient to allow me to slow Traveller down to a trot and start slinging even more deadly spells. My first use of Erionite in combat was even more exhilarating than the cavalry charge. I had already cast more spells today than I would have in a week as a spellmonger, or as a professional war mage, for that matter, and I wasn't even winded. The screening spell alone would have made me tired before Erionite, not to mention the wind spell, the scryings, and the illusions. But with the little Erionite sphere in the bag around my neck, it was as if I had access to an endless well of magical energy, and I used it lavishly. Bolts of death flew from my hands as I struck down each Gervan who crossed my path. Slasher flew from its sheath and hacked at their heads and necks at triple speed, as if it had a mind of its own. I fought using my mage sight, which allowed me to see through the thick smoke as if it were a light mist. I slew several Gervani who never even saw me. Traveler's hooves merrily stomped the shrieking survivors to pulp. We had maybe 4 minutes of pure, violent mayhem before the goblins got themselves organized enough to put up any effective resistance. Most, I noticed, were using crude but effective iron infantry swords, instead of their traditional maces and wooden clubs, and many had little round wooden shields, bossed with iron. Not that they did much good against trained warhorses and determined mercenaries. Especially not when their unit was as organized as an overturned beehive and half-blinded by smoke. A few spears and a few arrows flew at us, and one or two of Eric's troopers went down. But at that close range, I think the goblins did more damage to each other than to us as they flailed about. I was surprised at the number of bowmen, Bo Gervani among them. From what I understood, the Gervani prefer slings and javelins to bows, but they had picked up the craft. Archers can turn the tide in a battle, of course, but only when their fire is massed and well-disciplined, and this was neither. The greatest advantage to a cavalry charge, on the other hand, is momentum. When you get a man on a horse moving fast enough, it takes an awful lot to stop him. But after our 4 minutes, that momentum was spent. Individual troopers were attacking knots of Gervani, but the Gervani were starting to come together in larger masses, groups big enough to pull a man from his horse if they worked together and had enough leverage, and once on the ground, the advantage was definitely theirs. Eric knew his craft. When he saw a rough defensive line start to form through the smoke, it was time to go. He blew a horn that signaled a strategic withdrawal to his men, which is different from a retreat, as they explained to us in War College. When you are winning, it is a withdrawal. When you are losing, it is a retreat. The horsemen obediently finished off the opponents in front of them, and then started back the way they came to regroup. I stayed, which sounds like suicide or bravery, depending on your point of view. But the truth was I could do more damage here, covering their retreat, sorry, their withdrawal, than I could regrouping for another valiant charge. Kusi and his men would be hitting them shortly, and while our attack got their attention and hurt them some, there was still plenty of fight left in the goblin troops. I could at least do my best to distract them. Besides, it gave me a chance to try out a few of the more exotic war spells that we were taught, but that I never had a chance to use properly. Usually they take hours, or even days, to raise enough energy to hang. With this newfound power at my call, I couldn't resist playing around with them a little, any more than a brewer can resist sampling a new pint of ale. I wasn't that concerned for my personal safety, and perhaps I should have been. I was mounted only a few dozen yards away from the center of their unit, with enough little black hairy bodies piled around me to make me a daunting target. My personal defenses discouraged the few arrows they lobbed from hitting me, though they were becoming more numerous as the goblins gathered strength and organized. A few brave souls tried to rally their mates by charging directly at me, swinging their swords and growling. But as I burned them down, sometimes literally, their hair burns quickly and I favor incendiary spells in combat, as soon as they approached more than 20 feet, the number of volunteers to kill me diminished as the pile of bodies around my horse grew. For a long while, I just stared at them menacingly, as I decided upon which hoary old war spell to throw at the next one to attack. Goblins frustrate easily, and these poor idiots were already half-choked with smoke and half-blind in the sun. So they screamed at me and threw rocks, and occasionally feces, but it was clear they were not at their best. They were pretty spooked by first the fire, and then the attack. They huddled together on one edge of the pasture, trying to put their shields together in some kind of rough defensive formation, while their shaman tried to counter every sorcery I was hurling at them. I had just decided upon a really complicated but satisfying spell to try out, a nasty one from Imperial times that turned blood into a kind of congealed jelly. It usually took at least 4 magi to do it, when the shaman finally stepped out to challenge me. I could tell what he was instantly by the sudden glow in my mage sight. Using arcane power lights you up like a chandler's shop, but his costume would have given him away if my spellcraft hadn't. He wore a shaggy mountain goat cloak, and a headdress made of feathers and bone and leather, and he bore a staff in his hand. That staff almost stopped me. It was a 4-foot-long section of very straight weirwood, about 1.5 inches in diameter. The heel of the staff was shod with a sharp iron spike, which made it a dangerous mundane weapon, as well as a magical one. The head of the staff was a cage of iron enclosing another chunk of Irionite. Shit. I should have suspected it, and in fact, I did. But being faced with another witch stone in the middle of a battle was daunting. At least this time I had some parity. I abandoned my previous spell and concentrated on dumping power into a hastily created theoretical construction. After my last encounter with a Gervani shaman, I wasn't willing to pull any punches. Whatever he was going to try, I wanted to be ready to counter. I didn't expect him to try to argue with me. The shaman lumbered forward, his staff held in one hand, unthreatening but undoubtedly at the ready. He came to the line of bodies I'd piled up, looked down at them, and then back up at me, his lip curled in a snarl.
"Mage man,"
he said in Narasi, the language of the men of the 5 duchies. I was surprised. I shouldn't have been. I knew that the Gervani were capable of learning human speech, and I'd even seen 1 or 2 who had been taught to read.
"Mage man," he repeated, "leave this valley now. The Haku Gervani come to eat your brains if you don't. Many, many Gervani, many Kanga stones. If you love your life, you run away, run away."
During this charming soliloquy, the shaman had begun a kind of dance, rhythmically hopping from 1 foot to the other.
"Majman, run! Your bones will be gnawed by our young. We will eat your flesh. Run, run! The great ghost comes for your soul, little man. He comes for revenge. He comes to take back what is ours."
He ended his speech with a blood-curdling scream, which was echoed enthusiastically by the several 100 goblins at his back. Many were still coughing in the choking smoke, but many more were dancing on their own, brandishing their swords and clubs, or thumping them on their shields in an effort to be intimidating. I'm not ashamed to say that it almost worked. Here I was, alone, for the moment, against at least 200 screaming Gervani warriors. An impulse to kick Traveller into a gallop in the other direction seemed awfully tempting. I'd be a liar if I said otherwise. But I stood fast. Pride or honour, or just plain cockiness, kept me from flight. Or maybe I was just eager to practice more war magic. I stood fast and raised my own war staff. With mage sight, I could see the symbols of the shaman's magic awhirl around him and across his troops, which explained why more of them weren't choking to death in the thick smoke from the grove. The spells he had up were very basic defenses, from what I could tell. Simple, but extremely strong. Any arrow or rock aimed for him would miss. Any sword or mace would never land on his body. Nor was he vulnerable to regular war magic. A casually tossed bolt would dissipate harmlessly around him, or, possibly, be reflected back on the caster. Which was really a shame, as the spell I had been planning on using would have been very impressive.
"Gervani!" I screamed back. "You will die if you stay here! There are armies coming, armies that will drive you back into your dens in the high mountains. This valley will be filled with Gervani skulls, and there will be no more young to gnaw my bones. You have attacked us, and we will strike back hard. Lay down your arms and return to your homes. Remember the Great War, Gervani. Remember the fates of Grogoror, Gervani, and the mighty shaman Sherul, who died at our hands.
I was hoping that invoking their historic heroes and their failures might remind them of how outmatched they were. Much to my surprise, they started laughing instead. That wasn't quite the effect I was hoping for. I was even more confused now, but I was buying time, both for Sire Cousy to charge his heavy cavalry and for Rondo to get set up for the second charge, and for a brilliant idea to come to me if they failed to do so. I was getting nervous. I would have felt better with more horsemen to back me up, and the sight of a small army of hairy little bastards laughing at my most vicious threats wasn't helping my nerves one bit. I tried to keep that from showing on my face. I don't think I was successful. The shaman stepped forward again and grinned unpleasantly. His canines had been filed into vicious fangs, and his voice was loud and harsh as he challenged me, waving that wand around.
"I am Raiken, mage man. I am shaman of the Arinka tribe, the Red Hand tribe. My ancestors fought yours in the Great War. Then they fought for their homes and the sacred cavern, and you slaughtered them like pigs. Now, many years have passed. It is time for you to fight for yours. We will recover what was stolen from us. We will dine on your flesh. It is the will of the old god. He will bring justice to your people. Justice and death. But Raiken will have the honor of bringing death unto you."
He seemed pretty sure of himself. I could understand why. There's nothing like a huge chunk of Irianite to give a mage confidence. By that time, I thought Cousy was never going to come riding over the hill, and I wondered what was keeping him. Did he stop somewhere for a pint? Did he have to take a piss? Prior social engagement? My brain was all out of subtle magics that might quickly take down his defenses. So I improvised. I gestured with my finger, and the ground beneath Raiken was suddenly as soft as cotton under his bare feet. It's a spell that alters density, mostly in granulated materials, although I think it could work on solids if you powered it enough. I'd never done it on anything larger than a salt cellar, because it requires a lot of power to enhance the field. But then I had a lot of power, and the area affected was vast, about 3 feet wide. He sank, calf deep, into the suddenly loose ground, shrieking with surprise. In an instant he was about a foot shorter, and too surprised about the sudden change in density of the soil, not to mention his immobility, to do anything practical about it. Another gesture ended the spell, and he was mortared to the spot, just below his knees. His arcane defenses were still up, but his attention had wavered enough to allow me to attack. Holding a magical shielding spell takes concentration. He was too good to just let it expire, though, and while I weakened his defense, I had not dropped it. Just to be certain, I sent a magical bolt in his direction, and it missed him completely. Instead, it caught a goblin behind him for full effect, sending him reeling backwards among his fellows, much to the dismay of the other troops. The shaman began frantically waving his arms and drawing power from his witchstone in an effort to counter my spell, which allowed me a moment to knee Traveler forward and move Slasher into an attack position. If the others weren't going to do it, I could charge them all by myself. That's me. A one-mage cavalry unit. They teach you that at War College. When the conventional fight gets hard, rely on your spells. When the arcane forces you face are too strong, hit something with your blade. Hard. Or in this case, a horse. Traveler was a Rouncy, not a warhorse. But neither Raiken or Traveler apparently knew that. We were going at a quick trot in seconds, and the panicked look on Raiken's face was priceless as he realized that I was about to run over his hairy little ass. But I wasn't, really. One does not waste a good horse, and your only mount, unless the situation was dire, and it wasn't, yet. I just needed to make him think I was. As I bore down on him, he did about the only sensible thing that he could. He reversed the staff, so that the sharp, pointy end was aimed at me, and he braced himself. It was bravely done. Had I really been trying to run him down, I would have probably impaled my horse on it, just before my horse would have collapsed on top of Raiken. But that wasn't what I was after. As I neared the struggling little bastard, Slasher was in my hand, weaving through the air, flashing in the sun. With a war cry I perfected in the jungles of Faris, I aimed a blow at his head, which made Raiken flinch. Then I brought it up sharply against the body of the staff in an underhanded motion, the angle of the blow slapping the flat of the mage blade against the shaft. Raiken had expected to die, not become disarmed. The magical weapon leapt from the surprised Gervan's hands and flew through the air, where my free hand caught it neatly with the help of some war magic. Responding admirably to the reins, Traveller executed a neat turn around the left side of the flabbergasted witch doctor, stomped on some furry black toes that were too slow in moving out of the way, and trotted me safely back to where we started. The whole episode took about 60 seconds, and now I had his witchstone, and the stick he carried it around on. Raiken was irate, screaming for my blood in his own language. He didn't have to translate. I knew what he was saying by the way his troopers suddenly grabbed their swords and started toward me. I held up the staff triumphantly, and pointed at them, ready to blast the first one that crossed an imaginary line about 30 feet in front of me. It was a total feint, but they didn't know I didn't know how to use Gervani magic. "Tell them that I'll bake the first 6 that come any closer, Raiken, and after that I'll get nasty. Do it. Do it!" I commanded, trying to keep my words simple enough to be translated. I guess the disarmed shaman tried, but his angry troops didn't respond. They swept forward like a black, hairy tide. I realized that I would need a far more potent demonstration than a few bolts could generate if I wanted them to be in a position to take a charge. Tucking Raiken's toy into a saddlebag, I pointed my new war staff and fired off an impressive ball of fire toward the group. That made them pause, at least those who weren't hit by the blast. Hair catches fire quickly, and a few goblins got serious burns from the spell. I raised my staff at them again, and they watched it like a conductor's baton. "You have wrecked Himus. I call vengeance down on you," I said, or something like that. I could already feel the rumbling. "You have all died for nothing! You failed your gods long ago, and now you will fail them again. Here come the horse demons!" Kusi had finally arrived. My sphincter unclenched the tiniest bit. Battling down the hill like a shiny spear, the 100 or so horsemen I had been anticipating had finally arrived. The goblins noticed them too, and halted their advance to turn and gawk at them as they battled toward their disorganized flank in a V formation, their lances couched. I had to admit, it was almost as impressive to witness a cavalry charge as it was to take part in one. Sire Kusi, flanked by Sirs Ronsil and Stansil, and followed by the other Wilderlord knights, ploughed into the Gervani flank with a mighty clash and a chorus of war cries, and began sowing mayhem with sword and lance. Then the Black Flag's squadron, freshly reformed, attacked them from the other side, with ancient Irik leading his men into the thick of their band. There were less war cries and flourishes in their fighting, but the men knew their business. It really was beautiful, in a violent and gory sort of way. The slaughter took about 10 minutes to complete. Though the Gervani outnumbered the horsemen 3 or 4 to 1, they were demoralized and confused after being hit from behind twice in one day, and their short stature and shorter weaponry were designed for killing each other, not mounted armored knights. They went down under the spears, swords, and hooves of the Black Flag and the Wilderlords like ripe grain under a scythe. I didn't participate in any important way, although I helped Reserve Squadron keep any survivors from escaping to regroup or warn others. I would have helped the wounded too, if there had been any. It's not as if I was lazy or a coward. This was more massacre than battle, and there were men better equipped to deal with it than I. Ishi's tits. They lived for this sort of thing. I watched Raiken, still buried up to his knees, get wounded in the shoulder with a spear, unable to dodge or do anything else productive but bleed. He looked at me with a terrible anger and shouted, not a curse, as I expected, but a warning. "He comes, Mageman! The great ghost comes to damn you all! He is coming! He will..." Before he could utter another word, some trooper lopped off his head with a cavalry axe, then trampled his bleeding body until the legs broke off. When no more hairy foes moved in the bloody pasture, I rode through the carnage to meet a widely grinning Sire Cousy. Captain Ferrando was having a hard time finding anything to be depressed about. It was a victory. Cavalry charges are what knights are made for. We had but 3 casualties, and only 1 fatality, a broken saddle strap and a chance impalement. A remarkable result of what could have been a nasty encounter.
"Have you espied any more, Spellmonger?"
Sire Cousy asked, not wasting any words on battlefield reflections. I shook my head, but looked up at the mountains. "These goblins were easy to spot, my lord. They were clumsy, unsophisticated, and mere raiders. But the day is failing, and come nightfall, I have no doubt that Himus will crawl with their kin. We have struck a blow here today, but we will not save the town, I'm afraid, nor the castle. This band was over 2x as big as the one that hit Minden's Hall, and I'm afraid the next lot will be 3x this size. A mere vanguard, and little else. I would recommend that we police the area and return to the castle with all haste."
"Very well," nodded the Lord of Beauval. "There is little left in town that cannot be replaced, though the cost will be dear. And I must say that these mercenaries of yours performed admirably. For sellswords, my own men did a poorer job of attack than the Black Flag," he admitted. The one fatality had been a young squire. "You have a good eye for fighting men."
Captain Ferrando blushed and stared at his saddle horn, and I have to admit that I felt the weight of Sir Cousy's praise myself. You have to understand that the professional mercenary is not often commended for his work, particularly by the nobility who employs him. His employers often hope that he will be killed before he is paid, and the civilians he comes into contact with are usually annoyed that their hard-earned taxes have gone to support a fighting man with no loyalty but to his purse. Captain Ferrando did sit up a little straighter in his saddle.
"Well, my lord, I can only hope that the barbarian infantry in your employ will fare as well."
Ferrando nodded towards the rod I held in my hand.
"I see you have picked up a souvenir."
"I thought it would look nice in my new quarters," I shrugged. "But if nothing else, it was an instructive duel. We were damned lucky the thing didn't blow us all away, had something gone awry. These goblins play with powerful toys, sire, but they have little idea how to use them to fullest effect. Mayhap next time we will not be so lucky." With a nod and an uncomfortable sigh, Sire Cousy nodded, and then ordered Sir Ronsil to oversee the policing of the battlefield, while I did my best to suppress the fire I'd started in the first place. Most of the loot the goblins gathered from the town were left there to burn, but the troopers wisely took every iron mace, sword and axe they found. They could be reformed in the smithies of Beauval for things we needed, like arming the peasant militia, making arrowheads, or even nails. Ancient Eric's troops were detailed to collect goblin heads for display, and when we set off for the castle there were over 250 of the stinking things in sacks. By dusk, they were all impaled on posts at the crossroads near Himus. I doubt that they did any good as warnings, but I know that the sights of a victory, however small, encouraged the morale of the peasants who saw them from the battlements. Nightfall was fast approaching when we rode through the gatehouse and into the outer bailey. I wanted beer and I wanted to bathe, after the day's exertions, and I wanted to deconstruct the Govani wand and remove its witchstone. As the last horse came through, the iron portcullis and huge wooden doors were swung shut and bolted. The faces we passed were anxious, but relieved to see us. Sir Cousy made a point of calling out by name to those of his folk that he recognized, and engaging in spirited banter. My new liege was well-liked. That's an important consideration at the beginning of a long siege and a harsh winter. After handing Traveller over to the grooms, I made my way back to my tower quarters, more tired than I thought I'd be. I shouldn't have been surprised. While the magical power at my disposal was orders of magnitude above what I was used to, and came to bear as easily as breathing, my brain was still the same old brain. The intellectual exhaustion that comes from indulging in too many spells in too short of time can have devastating effects, So I vowed to myself to watch it after I stumbled twice on the stairs. Garkescu, I noticed, was enjoying a roast chicken dinner that made a waterfall out of my mouth. It wasn't standard castle rations, but I suppose he had a right to trade for extra food. That was inevitable in a siege. He even offered me some, but I could feel his apprentices glaring at the back of my neck, so I politely declined, knowing that they would split the leftovers from their master's table. I briefed him on the little cavalry raid and relayed the bare bones of Raiken's speech, and then excused myself, pleading exhaustion. I had taken the precaution of wrapping the Gavani warstaff in my saddle blanket before I came up, to avoid his questions about it. If he had known I now possessed two pieces of Irianite, things might have gotten tense, not cordial. When I finally got my tired feet to drag me up yet another flight of stairs to my chamber, I dropped the wrapped staff on my workbench, grabbed a loaf of hard bread and a sausage from the larder, and washed it down with a jack of ale instead of wine. I needed my wits about me for this next bit. While the thought of a big cup of sweet red reward was tempting, I didn't want to fall asleep while working with such powerful magics. That might be awkward. I cleaned myself up a little, took off my weapons harness, noted with pleasure that Tyndall had erected two large hammocks out of broadcloth and suspended them, and generally puttered around the lab avoiding the thing on the workbench. When I couldn't think of anything else that needed doing, I finally sat down, removed the blanket, and began my examination of the first Gavani magical weapon I'd ever seen. For the record, the thing was exactly 4 feet, 5.5 inches long from sharp, pointy spike to elaborately carved werewood head. The wood of the shaft appeared to be some type of hardwood. Folk, probably, pretty common in the mountains, and very thaumaturgically conductive, and had been carefully polished and sanded. The spike was just an ordinary hunk of iron. The decorations on the staff head were made of bone and leather, and copper wire bound the stone tightly into it. The stone itself was around 3/4 of an inch in diameter, although only a portion protruded from its housing. I made notes and a quick sketch of the thing on parchment before I started tearing it down. The spells on the thing were powerful, of course, and almost completely unfamiliar to me. That didn't stop me. I was trained in Imperial-style thaumaturgy, which is a well-organized and systematic approach to the subject of the science of magic that has been refined constantly since the first Archmage began writing it down. My own ancestors had used a more individualistic, shamanic approach, not unlike what Zagor used. There were other schools too, either derivative of the Imperial schools, which were in turn derived from the Alka Alon, so it was said, or crafted by individual traditions like the Cormeran Sea Magi, or the Wenshari witches. The Order of Avital, for instance, which is a Vorian clerical order devoted to the god of magic, whom no one pays attention to anymore, even in Merwin, except the Avitalines, has a wacky but effective system that bears only a passing relation to the Imperial school. Then there are the Sea Magi, the homegrown magi of the coasts, who have taken a cultic interest in the sea folk and use a derivative of their magics as their own. The witches of the Wenshari countryside use a hybrid of imperial styles and elements borrowed from the tribes in the Kulin Mountains. And then there are also the thousands of self-trained or apprenticed hedge wizards, foot wizards, and village witches throughout the duchies who have improvised personal systems that are loaded with superstition, expediency, and mixed with folk religion. My teachers at the academy used to sneer at them, good-naturedly, condemning their beliefs while mining them for useful information. The royal censors hunted them like dogs for their temerity and lack of credentials. The Gavani system of shamanic magic was, I assumed, a lot like my ancestors' original practice out on the steppes, much of which has been lost. Most tribal people's magic is similar in function, if not in form, after all. The symbols are different, of course. But one thing we learned in thaumaturgy was that all magical systems are inherently similar. As I scanned the thing with mage sight, I could see at least 4 major spells whirling around the length of the stick. Unfamiliar, but not unknowable. I dug out my own sphere and began disassembling them with care, shunting the excess power I drained from them into carbers, which I could use later if I needed to. I was especially careful. I had a classmate who blew two of his fingers off when he was carelessly disassembling an old wand he found in the research library at the academy. He was kind of a tool, so it served him right, but the event had made me cautious. The enchanting spells were typical for a war wand, though cruder than I was used to. There were binding, holding, directing, and projecting spells to channel the powerful forces available through the witchstone at the head. When I had safely disarmed them, the physical object was no more dangerous than a walking stick. I was amazed that there weren't any anti-tampering spells on it, but guessed that no ordinary Gervan would touch a shaman's staff. I pried the head apart with the blade of my dagger and held my breath as the Irianite tumbled to the bench, just like any old rock. It was, indeed, about 3/4 of an inch thick, irregular, and had one fairly flat surface that lent credence to Zagor's assertion that these stones were cut from a larger piece. I still didn't know how that was significant, but I did know that it scared me. There was a taint to it, I recalled the Aronin instructing me. I didn't dare touch it barehanded, yet. Using a pair of wooden tongs, I picked it up and gingerly set it into a wooden bowl. Then I set my sphere beside it, and went and poured the cup of the strong wine I'd promised myself. The link banishing process should have taken around an hour, according to Aronin. Just to be sure, I waited 2 hours before I went back and checked it. In the meantime, I wandered down through the crowded great hall and out onto the grounds of the Inner Bailey, and watched the Black Flag and the Crinrock tribesmen drilling for night battle. I was pleasantly surprised to see my young apprentice sparring with wooden practice swords with one of Ferondo's troopers. Tyndall saw me and grinned, which was a mistake. His sparring partner took advantage of the break in his concentration and whacked him in the shins, then proceeded to lecture him about focus. I chuckled to myself and left, not wanting to be responsible for more bruises. The lesson reminded me of my first 3 weeks at War College, when ancient Zim was daily screaming in our faces about how we held our blades like broomsticks. Night had fallen, and soon it would be too dark for them to practice any more, even by torchlight. I didn't have the strength at that point to summon a real mage light, so I let them practice until they couldn't. I just wanted to watch. The Crinrock didn't have the polish that the Black Flag had, of course, but those dumpy, shaggy little men made up for it with enthusiasm. Their drills looked an awful lot like a game between children, right up to the point where one of them was knocked unconscious. Furtak and Jordak were the leaders of the opposing sides, while their brother Poznak watched from the back of a wagon and gave advice in their guttural barbarian tongue. I climbed up the wagon and joined him.
"I heard the horse boys wiped out a company of goblins today, Minilin," he grunted out in thickly accented Narasi.
"Yes. We took almost 300 heads, I remarked.
"Solak, keep your shield higher or— Ouch, that must have hurt. Good work, Minilin. Plenty more goblins are coming," he said matter-of-factly. "Plenty more heads to take."
"You are right," I agreed. "How are the men here treating your people?"
Poznak shrugged. "Well enough for horse boys. They call us names, thinking we don't understand, but they are happy to see us. We call them names, too. Food is good. Walls are thick. Just waiting for goblins."
I couldn't argue with that. I took my leave of the barbarians and wandered to the Outer Bailey, using the excuse of checking on my horse to hide my true intentions, finding Alia, the freshly bathed widow I'd spotted this morning. The Outer Bailey had gotten a little more organized, but the stench of the crowded encampment was still just as overpowering, and promised to get worse. Militiamen bearing white baldricks and armed with cudgels patrolled the interior and did their best to break up fights, settle disputes, and make certain that the tiny cook fires allowed were being burned safely. A fire could wipe out most of the population of the southern Bovol Valley just as easily as the goblins could, and probably quicker, too. Fire protection spells only work so well in such a situation. Vigilance is the best ward against them. I skulked around the bailey anonymously after checking the stables. I said hello to old clients and cast a few useful minor spells where needed. Along the way, I made a few subtle inquiries about Alia's whereabouts, trying not to elicit too much interest. I didn't see her, so I finally gave up when it got too dark to see, and I was too tired to continue, and went back to the lab. It had been over 2 hours. Tyndall was back too, toweling off the significant amount of sweat that he had built up during his swordplay lesson. He shot me an excited grin before regaling me with tales of his prowess at his newfound art. I listened patiently while I removed the now purified lump of green amber from the bowl and put it in a small silk bag. I wish I knew the trick that Aronin had used for reshaping it, but the shape and form didn't matter much when it came to arcane power. Or maybe it did. I just didn't know. When my apprentice had wound down a bit, he started asking me about the raid he'd heard the men talking about. I told him as much as I could, sparing him the details like the groans of the mortally wounded Gavani that sounded almost exactly like the moans of mortally wounded men, and the look of terror on the faces of our foes as they realized that they were the objective of a cavalry charge. I almost felt bad for that. Battle isn't glorious on its face, particularly, but I wanted him to keep his enthusiasm, as he would need it sorely in the coming days.
What did Raiken mean by the Great Ghost? Is it one of their gods?
I shook my head. I don't know, and I have no idea. The mythology of the Gavani hasn't been studied much, and the culture of this band seems to depart in many ways from the common run-of-the-mill mountain folk.
How so?
Their weapons, for instance. They have far too many swords and shields and bows.